Hello, everybody. This is Dr. Diana Wiley. I'm your host of Love, Lust, and Laughter. There's a reason fairy tales always end in marriage, and it's because I think nobody wants to see what comes after. It may be just too grim. My very frequent friend and guest, Brad Coates, is back to help us understand this and many other things, although our focus today is going to be what women want, female needs, desires, and behavior in romantic relationships. Brad Coates is the author, fifth edition of Divorce with Decency. Welcome back, Brad, all the way from Hawaii. Wish we were there. How are you?
Brad is back, and aloha to you and all your listeners, Diana.
Yes. Oh, yes. Aloha. Your book, Divorce with Decency, is, it's in its fifth edition for a reason. And the subtitle is The Complete How-To Handbook and Survivor's Guide to the Legal, Emotional, Economic, and Social Issues. What you've done, because I had you on in 1999 when I lived in Hawaii, when your first edition was out. So you've been very good about updating it. And of course, it sold well, so that's the fifth edition. Can you just expand on that and a bit, please?
Well, it is pretty amazing. The University of Hawaii Press, which is my publisher, says that they've rarely, if ever, seen a book go into five different editions. And, it certainly is kind of bizarre to think that of a divorce book would go that way. But really, this book has turned into a lot more than being just a divorce book. I mean, the cover quote written by the former lead judge here in Hawaii in the family court, he refers to it as, this is far more than just a divorce book. It's an all-encompassing survey of love, marriage, and romantic relationships in modern life. And that's really basically what I've tried to do with it. I mean, the divorce laws don't change nearly as much as society changes, moving rapid. I mean, I've been writing and rewriting this book for 20 years now, and
yes.
The changes, I mean, there have been a few major breakthroughs in the legal aspects of divorce, like, same-sex marriage is a big example. But what's really changing is society and society's views of marriage, and a lot of that has to do with what the Wahinis are expecting out of marriage, and they're not always feeling very fulfilled about it.
Okay, so
women file for two-thirds. Go ahead.
Well, you said Wahini, and which you do often when we're, because you're my frequent guest, and I just adore you. But some of the mainland listeners won't understand Wahini.
Wahini is Hawaiian for women.
That's
the Hawaiian word for women. And it is the Wahinis, or women, or both, who file for like two-thirds of all divorces all across America. Guys will stay in a bad marriage, as long as they're getting fed three square meals a day and get to watch, sports on TV in their lazy boy lounger. They think that's a good marriage. Whereas women end about 80% of all relationships and file for divorce about two-thirds of the time because they expect something substantially more out of a relationship, some weird concept called communication, whatever the heck that is. Most of my guy friends don't even know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, so two-thirds of women file for divorce. And isn't it even a little higher than that for women over 50?
Could be. I think women over 50 are definitely one of the malcontented classes of females. I mean, a lot of younger women still are, into the program of I've got to meet Prince Charming and I want to have my biological clock is ticking and I want to have kids, et cetera, et cetera. But, after women have lived with guys for a long time, they find out that they're doing an awful lot of the heavy lifting in the relationship. And now they're doing a lot of the economic heavy lifting, too, because a lot of times the women are out-earning the guys. So that's a major, major change. So by the time they're 50, a lot of times the gals have had it with the guys.
And they're appreciating their independence after the divorce, their sense of privacy, their independence, their Expand on that a bit, because we may be jumping a little bit ahead, but...
I think that's spot on, because I mean, realistically, women, when you think about it, women all the way through their lives have had maintained networks of female support systems. I mean, everything from, you know, the junior league to the book clubs to the, you know, I mean, you know, women have sewing circles and circles of friends, and they communicate in depth with their friends. Guys, if you think about it, have a whole different approach. For guys, it's all about sports when they're young and competing on the teams, and then competing to work their way up the corporate ladder. You know, I'm a lawyer, so it's, you know, guys want to go from being a junior partner to being a senior partner. And, you know,
yes.
And guys have a harder time moving from what I call competing to connecting. As they get older, they've got to get more sensitive, and a lot of them can't really do it. And then they face retirement, and the kids are grown, and the women are sitting there looking at them saying, hey, you know, I haven't seen the kind of growth out of you that I feel I've gone through, or that a lot of my friends can give me, you know, and so guys come up short on that.
You know, in the early 90s, I did some research on aging and sexuality with Dr. Walter Bortz, and this is when I lived in Palo Alto, California, and these were very interesting studies we did, one at the Senior Center in Palo Alto, and the other with SIR, Sons in Retirement. And what we found was fascinating about aging and sexuality, but it was also published in medical journals, our studies. So that's why I get to call myself a gerontologist, somebody who studies aging, and in this case, aging and sexuality. So for older men, we found, and I think, so this is a long time ago, early 90s, but I think it still is true. For guys, and this was when we did the studies, this was pre-Viagra, but for guys, in a long-term relationship, if they had a woman who was interested and interesting, then they were happy campers. Their biggest problem at that time was impotence, because we didn't have Viagra. And for the older women, it was a lack of a partner. And this is still true. There aren't, for older women, and you talk about this in your book, that women will get divorced around 40 because they can still be a princess, and expand on that a little bit.
Well, I've noticed, you know, I don't want to overgeneralize, but I've noticed a lot in my clients and my circles, my own personal friends, that a lot of times, you know, women, you know, will get married sometimes in their, like I say, their 20s, early 30s, their prime childbearing years, and they'll marry a guy, you know, because he's there and because he's, you know, he's a sperm bank, or he's a, you know, he's a potentially good father. You know, a lot of times he seems like he's going to be a pretty decent guy. But once the kid issue is out of the way, and especially, you know, women who have taken good care of themselves or are still, you know, maybe had a lot of guys chasing them in the early days, and they're still thinking, well, you know, maybe I could have something that was a little more rewarding. I don't know if it's got to be a princess in an actual gilded cage, but, you know, just something that really is a little more rewarding to me than, you know, what I settled for maybe a little too soon. So, you know, when women get divorced by their early 40s or whatever, they, you know, they've still got a pretty good shot at having a whole another second installment of their lives. And I think a lot of them realize that, and it's statistically true, that if they wait till they're in their 50s, then that gets harder for women. You know, sometimes older guys, especially if they're wealthier older guys or established in some form or another career-wise, you know, maybe they'll still be attractive to younger women. But you know, the reverse isn't always true.
Not always true. You say that since marriage is no longer imposed by economic necessity, that brings us to a place where marriages aren't held together by need so much as by love. And, I think that's really true. So in my marital counseling, or even with some individuals who are thinking about, they're serious about somebody and they're not committed yet, I make the distinction between want and need. I think ideally you should say, ideally, I want you more than I need you. I can live without you, but I can live better with you. Well, lots of women can live without men now because they're earning more. And
more and more women can live without men, and they're doing it. You know, the feminist revolution has really changed the whole deal. When my mom was a typical 50s housewife, the Donna Reed, Leave It to Beaver kind of a scenario.
Right.
And I don't think she was dying to divorce my dad. But if she had wanted to, I'm not sure she could have. Dad had the paycheck. He had the checkbook. A lot of times women, they couldn't even get their own lines of credit or anything back in the 50s. Everything had to be signed off on by the husband, if you remember. So women did not have. Plus, a lot fewer women were working. A lot fewer those women that were working were oftentimes in lower earning jobs. I mean, you know, the glass ceiling had not exactly been broken in those days. So the women did not have, they didn't have the ability to cut and run, even if they wanted to. They were kind of stuck. And now that's totally flipped because you know, women are out earning men. You know, nowadays half the time, a third of the time anyway, if both halves of the couple are working, the woman's out earning the man. And and in a lot of cases, that economic change alone has shifted everything around as far as the women having far more options. And then what you were referring to, marriage being held together not by need as much as by love. So then the women, you know, turn to him, you know, turn about to the man and is, you know, look at him as more than just a paycheck because theirs is bigger than his anyway. And they start going, well, where's the love aspect of this? And unless the guys can come through on communication, then, you know, and really make the woman feel loved, they're screwed and they're about to get divorced, whether they know it or not.
Yeah.
So it's a problem. I mean, you know, you and I have talked before in prior shows about the studies that have been done on how much more communicative women are than men. And you know, Dr. John Gray and others in his Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus book, he points out that men have an average of only about 7,000 communication signals per day. That can be verbal communication. It can be shrugging your shoulders, rolling your eyes, whatever. But, you know, communicating somehow. Women are three times that, over 20,000 for women versus 7,000 for men a day. So, guys, get with the program.
Yeah. I read this somewhere. It's a take on John Gray's Women Are... Men are from Mars, women are from Venus, and it's men are from penis, women are from Venus. You know,
well, that is a pretty
men,
good way of words.
You know, the men thinking with their little head more. Anyway.
Well, and that, you know, it's weird because even that's gotten worse. You know, this is, you know, we're kind of jumping around here, but we tend
that's
to do that.
That's all right. We can do
such,
that.
Yeah. I mean, so now, in addition to the fact that, you know, men have got to deal with decreasing testosterone, they got to deal with impotence, now you've got a couple of other things that have intruded on the scene, which are, that didn't exist, you know, even when I wrote the first edition of this book, and those are porn and what you mentioned earlier, Viagra. So now you've got the twin problems. Let's start with the last one first. Guys take Viagra to get over the impotence issue. Now they've all of a sudden got an erection. Well, what a surprise. They want to use it. So, you know, this thing's up and going and they're ready to stick it wherever they need to stick it, which may mean they're skimping on foreplay. It may mean they're skimping on communication signals. It may mean they're skimping on, you know, looking into their lover's eyes. You know, it can be a big problem. So now you've got a woman who just feels like a sex object. And then add to that the proliferation of porn, where so many guys are getting it off by watching porn because they can't deal with real women and real relationships. So now you've got an even worse problem because guys who become reliant on pornography get this overstated sense of what women ought to be like, and you know, you've got these, you know, silicon stiletto heeled pumped up little 24-year-old, you know, little porn stars as being, you know, oh, this ought to be the ideal woman. And the guy then comes home to his, you know, 55-year-old wife and goes, and you know, so then now you've got men treating women even more as objects than maybe they have before. And those are sort of the unintended consequences of those two things. So the gals feel that, and you guessed it, they're out of here again. I mean, this is a serious issue.
It's a very serious issue. I have so many clients, including young men, who have been watching porn. You know, it's been available for, especially for men in their early 20s, you know, since they were in their teens.
Yeah, but not on their smartphones. Not on their smartphones it hasn't. You know, I mean, now it's just so widely available. It's crazy.
It's so widely available. So the expectations, so a man watching porn, often if he doesn't have erectile dysfunction, or if he does have it with a partner, he doesn't have it when he's watching porn because he doesn't have to worry about, as he masturbates watching porn, he doesn't have to worry about satisfying the fantasy woman on the screen. And then I have other men who aren't, you know, they find, you know, especially if they've been watching a long time, they say, I'm bored with it. It's not real. It's fake. And yet they're still drawn to it because it's a release. So porn is, you know, Brad, think about it. You know, we didn't have this problem 15 years ago so much, right?
Well, it's certainly omnipresent now with the breakthroughs in social media and smartphones and everything like mm-hmm. that. I mean, there's so much phony kind of relationships available that it's, you know, it's hard to focus on the real ones. I mean, real ones actually take real work. I mean, you know, when I was growing up, if you wanted to be with a girl, you met a girl in junior high or high school and you thought, oh, I'd like to go out with her, you had to actually call her up, putting
right.
yourself at risk of rejection, call her
right.
up, make a date, show up at the house, preferably in a car. You know, you actually had to own your own car, not just Uber. You had to, you know, have your shit together enough to bring her a corsage, take her to the prom, it was courtship skills that were learned. Nowadays, you know, the typical mating for the millennials is, you know, a guy texts a gal and says, hey, you know, me and my guy friends are going to be down at Joe's Bar tonight at 8. Why don't you and some of your gals come on over and hang with us? Is that a date?
That's right.
I don't know. You know, so the
intimacy
gets to be even less. And the skills required to maintain real relationships get to be even less. It's just, you know, it's potentially a real upender for society.
I believe so. And I'm seeing, I have some clients who are in their early 20s. Now, I recently had such a good-looking 24-year-old client, and we've had a couple of sessions so far. And he said he met his new woman on, I guess it's called Bumble, where it is up to the woman to swipe whatever, left or right, I don't know. I'm an old person.
Even if you did know, you wouldn't want to admit it on air, right?
Yeah, right. Anyway, so it gives the woman, in this case, a little more power. But it is the courtship. Courtships don't exist pretty much anymore with a lot of online dating. It depends. But it's such a new world, isn't it, for you and I? Kind of older people. I wanted to say old farts, but I don't want to say that because we're vital and we're fun.
Well,
but
you and I are
really,
anyway. But it is yeah. it is a serious issue. You know, the proliferation of pornography. The fact that the genders sort of are going their own separate ways anyway. I mean, this is happening big time. In Japan and other first world Asian nations where, you know, I mean, we've got here in Hawaii, you get a lot of these young Japanese girls that are, that are coming over here to go to universities in Hawaii just because they want to get the heck out of Japan. They don't want to be part of a society, the patriarchal society, where basically you marry a Japanese guy over in Japan and you're a slave to the mother-in-law for the rest of your life, and you're doing tea ceremonies and flower arranging because that's all women are really allowed to do, and hard charging women are looking for something more than that. So they come over here and they don't want to marry the Japanese guys, which means that the Japanese guys, are driven even further into their parents' basements, watching more porn and video games. I think we talked about this last time. There's this new term that I just unearthed for my book called teledildonics, which is basically having sex with robots. The Japanese are coming up with these teledildonics applications designed to create, and I'm quoting, a fully immersive high-tech sexual experience, including an actual sense of touch. I mean, what is that basically, having sex with a robot, right? So you get to the next query is when young men can bed beauties without ever leaving their parents' basements, will any of them ever develop the skills and the energy required to focus on real relationships? And that's, again, it's like, Nobody knows how to even call a girl up for a date and ask them out. It's like, all these linkages, unless they can happen over the internet with just a quick little swipe left or swipe right or a couple of cute little texts. There's the ability for face-to-face communication and probably body-to-body communication is probably diminishing.
Not probably. I think it is diminishing. And it's sad. And I'm so grateful that some of these young people, thanks to my website coming up on mobile phones, are calling me. And thanks to the fact that I'm living in Seattle, where young people often have good enough jobs to be able to afford my fee. You know what I'm saying?
It's interesting. I know you've moved your practice from Hawaii to L.A. and then from L.A. to Seattle, and I know part of it was to be near your kids, but it's interesting because there is another trend that comes out of Silicon Valley and out of Seattle, where these young boys essentially have gone from being teenage gamers to being computer coders, and then they're making a ton of money at the Google campus, and what springs up outside of the Google campus in Silicon Valley but a bunch of whorehouses. Because they don't have any, again, they've got now, potentially millions of dollars, and they've still never learned any of the social skills along the way. And so now you get a bunch of young girls coming in and taking advantage of the fact these guys have got all this money and don't know how to do anything else with the female except maybe pay them. So it's widespread.
And then in general about engineers, like to solve problems, and they develop algorithms. I mean, I know nothing about this, but I've read about it, right? So there are layers and layers of algorithms, and they like to solve problems. So they'll often come in for therapy wanting formulas for sex, and, of course, there aren't any. And sometimes they're disappointed. They want a formula for it. So I will say it's very important to be present, because that's really important for good sex, right? To be really fully present, to pay attention, and also to communicate. And some of these guys will want, well, how do I know if she likes how I kiss? Or how do I know if she's had an orgasm? Or how do I know this or that? But the thing is, they simply have to ask her. And because there's no formula, you have to ask her. So this is a problem for a number of engineers and other humans as well, right?
I was just going to say, how about trying to ask her? That might make sense, yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's, you know, in a way, it's a good thing that you provide the service you do as a relationship and a sexuality counselor, because you know, it's probably going to be more and more needed as more and more men live longer and longer lives, and the impotence thing becomes a bigger issue. I mean, when men used to drop dead at 50, maybe it wasn't a big deal, but you know, now that men are living to, you know, 80. You know, the last couple of decades may get precarious as far as their physical ability to perform, and it's thank God there's people like you around that can actually coach them through it, because a lot of guys don't, you know, you and I have talked about this before too, and I don't want to sound redundant, but you know, a lot of guys don't even realize that a woman takes literally 4 or 5 times as long as her man to reach, you know, true sexual enjoyment and hopefully orgasm. You know, and, you know, in the range of 18 to 25 minutes of foreplay alone, and for a woman to achieve orgasm versus, you know, 5 to 7 minutes for men. So that's a that's a major difference. And if the guys aren't understanding of that, and who better to teach them than you?
I
don't know.
You with your book.
They could read my book. That's right. Yeah.
Mention this. Orgasms, yeah. About 7 minutes for men average versus 18 minutes for women average. And it's true. And a lot of women feel shortchanged. Oh, and you also say in your book about the Viagra divorces and that once erect men tend to skimp on foreplay. Expand on that a little bit, as long as we've come into this.
Well, as I was mentioning before, I think now that through the wonders of modern science, men can achieve an erection just by taking a blue pill.
Mm-hmm.
Then they've got this erection and they're ready to use it. So, you know, you're ready to, for lack of a better word and sounding too gross, you're ready to stick it somewhere.
And that
means that maybe you're not, you know, kissing the other body parts. You're just ready to go straight to the, you know, straight to the big enchilada. You know, there's another interesting statistic that I read. There was a British group, I think, that did a study and determined that the average act of sexual intercourse lasts somewhere between 5.5 and 8 minutes. So if a woman takes 18 minutes of foreplay to get aroused and the average act of sexual intercourse is, you know, no longer than 8 minutes, the bad news is that that's going to be leaving a lot of unsatisfied wahinis.
That's true.
And, you know, again, and you know, I think guys have got to get a little more Akamai. Oh, there I go speaking Hawaiian again. Akamai
is
Hawaiian for smarter about things. And especially, like I say, as women start, you know, leaving relationships in droves. I've talked before about the man session and the free males. I mean, you know, the sociologists are coming up with cute little terms to talk about how unimpressed women are with men. it's a trend that we're watching, and I don't know, you know, so much of this is happening so fast that society doesn't have any real roadmap to figure out how all this is going to go. You know, I mean, at least when we started smoking in the 1950s, you know, the Surgeon General was able to issue a report saying, hey, this could lead to cancer. You know, we've got decoupling. We got people living together instead of getting married, which makes for less continuity. More kids being raised out of wedlock. I mean, half the kids born to women under 30 nowadays, all across America, are born out of wedlock. One half. Yeah. I mean, you know, and
single mothers can raise
kids just fine? I'm sure a lot of them can, but I mean, we don't know what's going to happen if they can't. And you know, you read other statistics about every time a new partner rotates in and out of a single mother's life, the adolescent children's bad behavior increases by 12%. I mean, you know, and they're doing studies on this stuff, it's going to make for potentially some, you know, we're seeing it in some of our inner cities where the public assistance to unwed mothers gets some more money than they can make at a job, and so they, you know, even if they wanted to get married, they can't afford it economically. So you know, you don't have a father figure around, and you know, maybe guys are not all that important in raising kids, but you know, the argument could easily be made that a male figure in a kid's life, especially a male child's life, is pretty important. So,
it's very important.
Kind of an interesting and somewhat perilous path, I think, that nobody's really thought through.
Well, it's one reason your book is in its fifth edition. You keep finding new trends and new information to add. I mean, it's kind of scary. It's kind of scary what's happening with single mothers and in inner city stuff, right?
I remember when I'm old enough to remember when, and most of your listeners probably aren't, Vice President Dan Quayle, came out and Candace Bergen had just appeared in that and as Murphy Brown, a single mom on TV, and that was the
That's
first
right.
time you've seen a single mom on TV. And Dan Quayle said, "Hey, you know, this maybe isn't the role model we're looking for in society." And he just got slammed.
Right.
Come on, you're an old curmudgeon, and you're a throwback to the Stone Age, and I don't think he ever lived that down. But really, nobody has taken a serious enough look at this stuff, so it is pretty wild.
Was that was like mid-80s, Murphy Brown? And
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe even late 80s, I'm not sure.
Maybe late 80s,
but
yes. I remember it, as you do. There have been so many so many societal changes and transformations and
well, I got a slew of them. If you got time, I can go through a bunch of them for you.
Yeah, let's do that, Brad. That would be good, because those statistics are in your book, and I think they illuminate very well. They support what you're talking about. So let's go through some of them.
Well, I can quote you some that I give. I've been given a bunch of speeches lately in support of the fifth edition of my Divorce with Decency book, and the Coates and Frye law firm that I run is the biggest divorce firm in Hawaii here. So I go through a lot of this stuff all the time. Here's some interesting statistics right here. In 1960, only 32% of wives worked, but by 2008, it was 61%. So it went from one third to basically two thirds.
Yeah.
In 1970, which was right when I was going to college, two-thirds of college graduates were men. Now, for every two guys who graduate from college or get a higher degree, three women do.
Mm-hmm.
Here's an interesting one. Women's earnings increased 44% in the period from 1970 to 2007. How much did men's go up? 6%. So women increased 44%. I mean, they're still making less than guys, and they still haven't quite broken through the glass ceiling. But you know, men's industries have been tougher, and women have really risen 44% versus 6% for guys. Realtors will tell you that there are far more single women who own their own homes than do single guys. The single guys are still in their parents' basement. So it's women are now the main breadwinner in 22% of all U.S. households, and that was 7% in 1970. In about half of all marriages, the wife is better educated than the husband. So you've got a situation. I've referred to it in my talks as the frustration dichotomy that begins to creep in here for the Wahinis. You know, even in addition to having to assume her, role in the employment market, in the job market, working a full, working every bit as hard as her husband does at a real job, a woman comes home and she's still got to spend an average of 102 minutes a day caring for her family. For guys, it's 48 minutes. So the work burden has been taken on by the women professionally, but the household burden, hasn't shifted all that much.
Right.
It's estimated that globally about 38% of men don't do any chores, period. So you can sort of see why the women might be getting a little upset.
Sure. What did you say, 38%?
38% of men don't do chores, period. That's globally. I mean, that counts Muslim men who have five wives to be doing everything,
and all they do
is beat them with a stick. So, who knows. And I shouldn't come down on Muslims, but I mean, it's not a liberating philosophy for women, that's for sure.
No.
But yeah, in the U.S., it's gotten to be really quite a liberating situation, and so a lot of these women are acting on their new empowerment. So here's a new term that I mentioned earlier, the man session, referred to as a matriarchy of overachieving females presiding over a cadre of slacker dudes. And you could just kind of see it, you know. And the more women take on the serious roles in society and in the household, then they really don't need the guys around. I mean, you know, the more women start assuming the lead function in relationships, including earning it in the job market, still doing all the chores, you know, even the stuff that guys used to be needed for, you know, reaching the high shelf in the pantry or you know, mm-hmm. fixing the car or whatever, guys are basically being relegated to a lot more, you know, a lot less necessary functions around the country. And you know, as soon as men lost the advantage of being able to physically overpower their wives, it's turned out that women, are a lot more skillful on a lot more levels than guys are. So guys are being relegated to even more insignificance.
And that's so when, because my experience of both personally and professionally is that the healthiest relationships are fairly egalitarian. There's equal give and take. So you're describing an imbalance that results.
Well, it's an imbalance that seems to be getting more pronounced.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, there are some guys that are waking up and spilling the coffee and trying to, you know, I mean, a lot of, like, one in five men with kids is now a stay-at-home dad. So you get guys that are figuring out this and the need to be involved on a more serious level.
Mm-hmm.
But it is, it is problematic, to say the least.
Yes.
There's kind of an interesting irony here because, the more economic independence and the more education a woman gains, the more likely she is to stay married.
I think that is fascinating, that trend.
Say again?
Talk about that because that's fascinating, the trend that the more a woman is able to be financially independent. Finish that up.
Well, what's happened is that you've got a situation where marriage is declining across the board. We all know that. I mean, fewer and fewer people are getting married. People are waiting longer to get married. It used to be, again, when you and I were, coming out of college, people actually married their college sweethearts. The average age for marriage in the 60s was guys at 23 and women at 21. Now it's up to 29 for guys and 27 for females. So it's the oldest age for first marriages in American history. So fewer and fewer people are getting married to begin with. More and more people are just cohabiting and just living together.
Yeah.
But what's happened is that marriages remain popular because it's a financially smart move. You know, there's been all kinds of studies that show that, that people who stay married accumulate more, more wealth over time and are healthier. I mean, it's healthier, especially for guys to stay married. So there's a lot of reasons why society wants to keep marriage intact. But what's really happening is that because people are now so frequently choosing to cohabit instead of actually going all the way to an actual marriage, that has reached a situation where marriage remains popular amongst the better off and the better educated, but the working class and the poor people. It shows that people who cohabit. For example, 2/3 of college graduates are married, compared to less than half of those whose education ends at high school. So what they're doing is they're cohabiting. The less educated people are just saying, okay, well, let's just shack up together. Maybe let's have a kid, whatever. Those that have pushed harder on their life, they've gone to college, they've got their shit together, they're making, they're really upwardly mobile types, they've figured out that marriage is good for upward mobility.
Yeah.
So those with college and postgraduate educations now tend to marry one another. So now you've got a situation where the high school people whose education stopped at high school are just living together, having kids, oftentimes breaking up. The breakup rate is much higher amongst people who cohabit than those who get married because, the social glue still holds some marriages together, not entirely, but, there's still that glue that marriage gives you. So you've got a sort of a grimly self-perpetuating phenomena that occurs where 2/3 of the kids born to unmarried parents later on have to witness them splitting up.
Mm.
So experts are projecting that as marriage rates continue to decline, the gap between the haves and the have-nots will continue to grow. The haves and the educated and the wealthy will marry one another and stay married, and those that are on the lower ends of society will you know, stay unmarried and stay, you know, having all the problems that sometimes cohabitation can bring. So that's that's another social trend that, again, you see that in the inner cities, you see it, you know, with our colleges, you see it, the people who go to med school, the doctors marry each other, they go to law school, they meet, the lawyers marry one another, they pair up in those kind of power couple kind of linkages, whereas people that have stopped short of that have got a tougher road to hoe.
And you write about a lot of this in your book. I mean, you put on your sociologist hat a bit.
Well, I love statistics, and I think sociology is interesting. I mean,
yeah,
the demographics, and nobody's really talking about it. I mean, my book's much more than just, I would have been probably, frankly, bored with being a divorce lawyer. I've done probably, my Coates and Frye firm has probably handled like 30,000 divorces. I got 11 attorneys here doing nothing but divorce work for 40 years. That's a lot of divorces. And I personally have probably
divorces.
Done 7,000 or 8,000 of them. But what's really become more intriguing to me as an academic, and as, I don't fancy myself as really an intellectual, but intellectually speaking, this stuff is much more interesting than just chopping everybody's, pension plan in half or,
Yeah.
I mean, how smart do you have to be to be a divorce lawyer and chop everybody's assets in half? So this stuff is much more interesting to me than the divorce stuff itself. It's trying to figure out what the root cause of all this stuff is.
Root cause. And you do that, you go on cruise ships, and you talk about preventing divorce. So why don't you talk a little bit about that right now? I mean, we have talked in the past, but for this show.
Well, it's probably bad for business, but I take a perverse pride when people come into my office and say, hey, I'm on the threshold of a divorce, and, what should I do, and how should I approach this, and, are my problems similar to other people's problems? I frequently talk people out of getting divorced. I won't say frequently. I mean, my main job is to be a divorce lawyer, but when I sense that there's a way to recommend counseling or mediation or try and put it back together or give them a copy of my book or try and direct it. I mean, my book has actual chapters in it that are specifically geared for this kind of stuff. I mean, I've got, chapters on Can Your Marriage Be Saved and understanding the basic biological differences between men and women and key tips on preserving and improving your marriage. And I talk about second marriages, which sometimes can be better than first marriages. Certainly from your favorite perspective, which is the sexual component, second marriages can oftentimes be a lot sexier than first marriages. I try to make something useful out of the process. So many divorce lawyers, they just look at it from the strictly legal aspect of, like I say, chopping everybody's assets in half. Whereas I figure, hey, I've been given, I mean, I didn't start out my career as being a divorce lawyer. I didn't go through law school thinking, oh, God, when I grow up, I'm dying to be a divorce lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
I joined a firm that didn't have a divorce lawyer. I was the new kid on the block. They said, you're going to be the divorce lawyer. I said, okay. But if you find yourself in a position like I have where you actually are able to positively impact, I mean, it's when people go through divorce, they're going through one of the threshold crises, choke points in their lives. And, there is the opportunity that's exercised too infrequently, in my opinion, to try and actually learn from your mistakes in your first marriage or whatever, and maybe be better in a second or third marriage or whatever. So when save the marriage or whatever you can come up with that makes it a holistic and positive kind of growthful experience rather than just, meat axe down the middle, chop up everybody's assets and move on, which is what most divorce lawyers do.
I so often quote you, Bradley, and that is learn and improve.
Yeah.
Often quote you, even with my clients. It's just, you've said it doesn't have to be a failure if you keep your eyes open and you learn and improve. That's a very valuable lesson.
Yeah, and it's not focused on nearly often enough. I mean, way too few couples that go through or going through divorce ever try marriage counseling. You know, like, you know, 1 in 10.
Hmm. Only one in ten have had marriage counseling.
Well, I've heard between 1 in 8, 1 in 10, but it's not as prevalent as it should be. Because again, if you want to learn something from your experiences, you might want to talk to somebody that understands this stuff. They might
Indeed.
Want to talk to you specifically.
And yeah. In terms of my own experience, sometimes it's too little, too late.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, my clients coming in, but usually it's not. And I approach a couple coming in who are on the verge of divorce to be optimistic. And, well, let's see, is there enough at the foundation of your relationship that maybe we can build on? And sometimes there isn't. So then I have to go into my divorce mediation mode, which I'm trained in, but...
You certainly are. They don't call you Dr. Diana for nothing.
Yeah, well, oh, but don't we... You know, one reason that I admire you so much and have for now 20 years plus... Nope, I guess 20 years. Oh, let's see. Yeah, almost 20 years.
Yeah, almost 20 years.
Yeah.
And we've stayed close even as you keep hopping around from state to state.
Oh, I know. So is that you are such a good man about wanting to help couples preserve their marriages, and you do that when you go on cruise ships and speak. And we've done that a number of times on our show here, my show with you.
I love being on your show. It's great.
Well, thank you. And I love having you. I think really going back to 1999 and then the many times you were on my show in Hawaii, and then on Progressive Radio Network. So I think you're my most frequent guest.
Well, and, I'm flattered.
Yeah, well, you should be, but I should be very happy about it, and I am. I really am, Bradley. You know, you're just such an amazing man. You're so wise, and you have so much experience, and you're funny.
And hopefully we're not done yet. I mean, didn't we talk about trying to do a show? What did we talk about? Tuesday,
January
9th is what I've got written down, where we're going to talk about what men want. Men ought to get equal time.
So let's, in the time we have left, yes, we are going to do that for sure. So in the time we have left, maybe we should wrap this up, because the promise of the show was what women want, female needs, desires, and behavior in romantic relationships. I think we've covered a number of points. Maybe one that we could expand on a little bit is, and you put this in your book, as women step into formerly male-dominated roles, they have more choices, but also more stress.
Yeah.
Because choice is inherently stressful. Maybe you can talk a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's kind of true. I think she's in Time Magazine, a columnist named Maureen Dowd, who I like to quote a lot. She writes an interesting article called "The Decline in Women's Happiness: A Complex Phenomenon."
Mm-hmm.
And she talks about how the women start out their lives being more fulfilled than men,
mm-hmm.
but gradually get less happy as they age. This is as versus men, who get happier as they get older. So what she talks about is that women may be more powerful today, but they're less happy. They've broken the glass ceiling. They're partners in law firms. They're running, they're Secretary of State. They're running for president. Kind of a shame that maybe they didn't win. And so you've got Wahinis, you know, taking charge in a lot of areas, but that's stressful. I mean, you know, I'm a partner in a big law firm, not a big law firm, but a mid-sized law firm. It's stressful. I come into work every day and I'm dealing with litigation and win-win and everybody trying to cut each other's throat. I mean, you know, so now you've got a bunch of women that are in that area too. Women are much better at mediating through problems, and a lot of times they're actually better as CEOs because they can sort through the personnel and other problems. But still, it's all stressful. I mean, you know, business, that's why they call it work, because it's work. You know, you got to go to the office, and so you're taking on all the stuff that women in the feminist revolution have sought for their lives. A lot of it they've achieved, and then the question is, you know, where does it leave them? So women are more powerful, indeed, earning higher, but potentially less happy. So especially of lately, marriage, the area that I focus on, has apparently turned out to be more beneficial for husbands, whereas wives' marital satisfaction levels seem to have declined a bit recently. So, you know, the economic gains associated with marriage are now greater for men than they are for women. And, you know, again, Maureen Dowd. She poses the question, did the feminist revolution end up benefiting men more than it did women? Because the midlife crisis is now a woman's issue, too. And she notes a recent spike in female suicides. So, you know, women have now got a lot of increased power and performance in society, but they've got all the stress that goes with it. So maybe it's an oops. I don't know. I don't know if we go back to the 1950s and Donna Reed days.
We don't want to do that, but that's a fascinating statistic, that there has been an increase in female suicides. I mean, it's been male dominated for years.
Well, here's one that I do know. I don't know exactly how much female statistics have increased, but according to Maureen Dowd, they have. And then I came across an interesting thing, and maybe this is an interesting one possibly to conclude on, or as we get closer. This one, take this for a wild one. This is a grid that I came across that charted a graph that purported to show what they call a happiness hierarchy based upon marital status and gender. So the happiest people in society in America today are married men. Next happiest, single women. Third happiest, single men. Who's the least happy? Married women.
Wow.
How wild is that? And it just shows that women are becoming more and more likely to be happy being single than men. And I see that all the time. If I'm doing a divorce for a 50-year-old guy, one of the first things he's going to do is going to go out and start looking for a new gal, probably to take care of him, and see if he can't get remarried, usually within a couple, 3 years. In fact, when I do a divorce, if a guy is coming in as the client who's initiating the divorce, it's almost always, not 100%, but, you know, probably two-thirds of the time, it's almost always because he has a new gal in mind who's waiting in the wings, or he's looking for, you know, to leave a first wife to go be with a second wife or whatever. He's already spotted his secretary or whoever he wants to hit on next, or maybe halfway into having an affair or whatever. Then a guy will get divorced. Guys will rarely get divorced for the same reason women get divorced, which is the more mature reasons, like, hey, I don't feel like we've got a mature communicative relationship. I mean, you know, I've never heard a guy in 40 years of practice come in and say, you know, I feel like I need a divorce because my wife doesn't communicate.
I bet not, right. Oh, my goodness.
I've heard him come in and say, you know, my wife doesn't put out for me anymore sexually. I've heard that one a lot.
Of course.
I've never heard, you know, we can't have deeply meaningful philosophical, you know, conversations over dinner
out
of guys. And yet that's exactly why women get divorced. And so back to my grid of what happens when a guy gets divorced at 50, he's ready to get remarried almost right away. When a woman gets divorced at 50, first of all, her chances statistically of getting remarried have diminished some. And second of all, she doesn't want to get remarried. So you get the British are calling it free males, more women happily staying single. Britain are now seeing the lowest marriage rates on record and more free male women living alone in Britain. The solo rate doubled within the last 20 years for women, even in the prime marriage age. And I mentioned that about Japan. We call them the boutique babies in Japan that live in their parents' home, refuse to get married, take all the money they're making in by being an office girl in Japan or whatever, and they come over to Hawaii and spend it in our boutiques. They don't, you know, they're not interested in traditional housewife roles at all. And the British women are the same, and the American women are the same. You know, we've talked about Jane Fonda's book, Prime Time, which I think is a great book.
Yes, in the last show we talked about. I love that book, Jane Fonda's book, Prime Time. Yes.
And remember what she says. They asked her, you know, which of your, you've been married to all these, you know, these fascinating men, Ted Turner, Tom Hayden, Roger Vadim, French film director, you know, all these, you know, kind of interesting guys.
Right.
And he said, which of these guys, if you had it to do over again, which one of them would you wanted to stay with? And she goes, none of them. She goes, I'd rather be with my girlfriends and on a yoga mat and just hanging out with the gals. So it's a whole different deal. Guys come right back into the fold and want the women and want to be back in that, you know, in that configuration. Mainly because they get taken better care of, they live longer, they stay healthier, they eat healthier. I mean, you know, I got a lot of single guy friends, and they, you know, an all Cheetos diet is not exactly the key to longevity.
Not at all. So as we come to the final minutes of this program, I want to remind the listeners that Bradley Coates will be back again the 9th of January, the new year, 2018.
Can you believe that, 2018? Holy cow.
I can't believe that.
Remember
you know,
when everybody
the
thought
older
the world
I
was
going
to come to an end at the new turn of the new millennium, the computers were going to melt down, and everything was going to come to a dead stop at the year 2000?
I know.
18 years ago, for Christ's sake. That's 18 unbelievable.
It's just amazing. But, Brad, I'm just so pleased that you're a regular on this program because you add so much. And I just and then I get to talk to you because you're my longtime friend. And
it does keep us in touch, and I love it. And hopefully your listeners get something out of it. And don't forget to tell them to buy Divorce with Decency if they think it's interesting,
please.
This stuff. I think it's
that's right.
Go on Amazon and grab the fifth edition of Divorce with Decency.
It's a wonderful book. It's just an amazing book. Divorce with Decency, the complete how-to handbook and survivor's guide to the legal, emotional, economic, and social issues.
And you know who's quoted in it somewhat extensively is none other than Dr. Diana Wiley, because you actually brought a lot of this stuff. When I was first writing this book, I remember coming to you, and you brought me a lot of insights from the get-go.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Brad.
Aloha
okay,
from
everybody.
Hawaii, everybody.
Take care and aloha, as Brad would say. Yes. Bye-bye.